Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, we're talking with Trey Radel. He has a new book out called Demo Crazy, A True Story of Weird Politics, Money, Madness, and Finger Food. Trey, thanks for talking to us.
Hey, it's great to be with you. Thank you so much for having me.
So you were a U.S. congressman from the 19th District in Florida, is that right?
That is right. Okay. The Fort Myers, Naples area. It's where many of perhaps your retired grandparents live.
And you entered office. You won in 2012, kind of as part of the last surge of the Tea Party. A professional broadcaster before that, and then you lasted about a year in Congress. Tell our listeners, Reason's listeners, what happened, which I think will jog a lot of their memories.
Sure. First rule of Fight Club, don't buy cocaine from a federal agent, is where I'd start. And while I poke fun at myself, it sucked. It was, I got caught up in very bad habits that ranged from drinking too much to making really stupid decisions. And I paid a really serious price. And, you know, it's one thing to pay the price for the position that I worked very hard to get, which was a representative in the United States Congress, and to get there and just toss it all away. But what was the hardest that I would quickly come to grips with was what it did to my family, to my wife, and really to my son, who's only 5 years old now, but who will grow up knowing that, you know, it was his dad that, has this notorious label, and it sucks, man. It's terrible. It's awful. But, you know, you go through life and you can either choose to dwell in the past. You can be paralyzed for the future, or you can just try and live. And that's what I have tried to do, and had, you know, both some personal and professional successes since my sort of demise in the United States Congress. But, it is what it is, and it was awful. I was making terrible choices. While I may be a harsh critic of the war on drugs, the fact was is I was a lawmaker, and I broke the laws of this country like an idiot.
We'll talk though, because in the book, and this book is one of the things that really struck me about it is the kind of honesty and urgency of the prose, and also, I mean, you do a really good job. At times I almost felt like I was reading the book that Goodfellas is based on, because there's that delirium where, you know, as things are starting to happen and you're getting out of control. I mean, it reads, and I hesitate to say this, but it reads like a great kind of junkies novel of, you know, that everybody involved knows this is not going to end well. And it's, you know, it's powerful that way. I mean, it's a really powerful recreation of that. What was going on, you know, how, what was seductive? Talk about the life of a congressman and what it was like day to day in terms of, you know, during the day you're making laws and you're fighting with people in the other party, sometimes your own party, and then it's time to party, right? I mean, do more people get swept up in this than we, you know about from reading the newspapers?
I don't know. I will be very honest. I don't know anyone who is as much of an idiot as I was in terms of, you know, the vice choices that I was making. But to go through a day in the life of a United States congressman, it's insane. And in some ways, in a great way, and other ways that can be definitely detrimental to a person if you get caught up in certain vices or you want to have a stable family life, because it's very difficult to balance all of that. So, you know, you wake up in the morning and the day starts with these hilarious, monotonous party meetings that you go to, and they can be either political, where you have to get out of the United States Capitol or any of the grounds on the Capitol, and you go to political meetings in a completely different area, that's sort of off campus, if you will, because politics and actual lawmaking cannot exist.
Right, and
together.
So that's when you talk about when you say it's political, that has to do with party stuff, fundraising.
That's exactly right. So you go into these meetings, and it's like, you talk for about 2 seconds about the bigger picture policy things that you'd like to accomplish, and then everything else is Now let's talk about how we're going to raise more money. And it goes on and on. So you go to these meetings, then you go to policy meetings or you're in committee, then you go and vote. I will tell you that in terms of office time, man, I would remember rolling into work and having 15-minute meetings scheduled back to back for 7 hours straight. And you know, some of that is on the burden of the member of Congress that they need to take more control of their schedule. And other times, you know, look, this is the work that you've been elected to do that you ran to do, and you got to crank it out. I personally loved that stuff. I had no problem working crazy hours. I'm a type A personality. That's part of, you know, with assets and liabilities, that, right. That's both an asset and liability. But what I really loved was people. That's, you know, one of the reasons that I love being a journalist, which I was for, gosh, 20 years. And anything else that I've done is I love interacting with people. And to sit there and have these meetings, sure, it can sometimes are a little monotonous, or, you know, you get the next 50 people to tell you the way that they think you can solve the national debt and crisis and all that. But whether it was wildly optimistic or romantically naive, I truly felt like I was doing good for the country, and I loved it, man. I loved meeting with people from all walks of life and doing that. But you're in these meetings, and then the bell rings, and you go and vote, and then you come back and meet with people. Then the bell rings, you go and vote, then it's committee, then you meet, then you go. And then, you know, maybe 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock rolls around, you go out for some beers, maybe you hang out with staff a little bit, maybe you go out with other members of Congress. I in particular, really enjoyed hanging out with Democrats, that they just happened to be my group of friends. And so while I could spar with them on the House floor here and there, you know, at night, it was like, let's have some cocktails and, you know, use some adult language and talk shit and talk policy. It was fun.
What, you know, one of the ironies of your of the book is that in a farm bill, you ended up voting to drug test welfare recipients or pushing forward on that. Go ahead. Well, it comes back and, you know, obviously haunts you. And that was the lead in every story about your arrest.
Yes, which was just not true.
Yeah.
Like if to say that to go again to my libertarian beliefs, one of the hardest things that I tried to wrap my head around was the fact that I got labeled this hypocritical, you know, drug abuser guy that wanted to really, pardon my language, fuck over poor people or people with problems. And that really, it still gets under my skin today. And here's why. Number one, I have very personal issues that are attached to it with my own family. I have sympathy, I have empathy for people going through rough times from my own experiences and from family members. Two, I have been since my days of that I began to follow politics as a teenager, I was against the war on drugs. I have very hardcore libertarian beliefs that sometimes even get misconstrued for liberal. Now, I say all that because I got slammed with this label that I voted the drug test food stamp recipient. So it's saying that I did that, number one, is like saying every time a Democrat votes for some shitty CR or omnibus bill, you know, these giant blobs of ambiguity called policy, that they are voting to, you know, let's think of stereotypical things, that liberal Democrats have voted to give big oil tax breaks and subsidies, or liberals are all funding the big evil war machine of the United States military. It's just not right. So what I voted for was something that was very consistent with my libertarian beliefs. There was a policy in that farm bill that basically said states can make their own decisions on what to do when it comes to administering any welfare in their state. I don't give a damn if Colorado wants to legalize marijuana, go for it. Here in Florida, I just voted for in our state by 70% voted to legalize medical marijuana. And I believe each state should be more autonomous from the federal government, should be able to make their own choices. And I voted for this. I never, ever voted to directly have food stamp recipients tested. And that's something that I explain in the book. But, you know,
live in the past. The story kind of goes, or that discussion point kind of goes to, you know, the larger picture of political dysfunction that you paint with an incredible brush in the book. And, you know, you were mentioning omnibus bills and continuing resolutions. I mean, in your time in Congress then, I mean, Congress wasn't, they weren't really passing budgets, and they were doing everything to kind of keep the train running. What is, you know, is it possible, in your opinion, to, you know, to act, like, what has to happen that Congress kind of gets serious on the most basic level of spending, only spending as much as they're taking in a given year, or either trying to be serious and say, oh, you know what, we actually want to spend $4 trillion a year, and we're going to raise taxes to do that. But, you know, and it, I mean, is political change possible, and what is the precondition for a kind of more functional Congress, not in terms of people necessarily getting along, but actually doing something sustainable?
Yeah. So I, you know, as nerdy as I am, I do get pretty heavy into the book about mandatory spending and how I believe that I compare mandatory spending to the housing bubble in the United States back in 2008. It was there in everybody's face. You had dudes who were bartenders one week and then mortgage brokers the next, in the clubs, you know, buying bottles of Kettle One and telling me about how they're lending money to dudes that have no money, no job, and no assets, called ninja loans. It's one of these types of things. I believe our federal debt and our deficits are very similar to the bubble of the housing, in the way that it's like right there in front of our faces, and no one really even recognizes it. So, Nick, I'd say that my most wildly optimistic bet on that is no one does a damn thing until mandatory spending, which is right now, what, 60-65% right. of our budget.
Yeah, when you throw in, if you throw in interest on the debt, it's about two-thirds,
So I think that we don't do anything to correct or to even tamper down mandatory spending, which, again, are very simple: Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. I don't think anything gets done until we truly see other types of things compromised, whether it's, you know, to use sort of stereotypical Democrat and Republican issues, Republicans' military gets crowded out, or with Democrats, any kind of welfare spending at all, or any projects that they want get crowded out. That's the optimist in me. The pessimist in me is we go full Greek. Mm-hmm. And when I say that, you look at Greece and what happened there was basically they had to look us, you know, the 65-year-old in the eye, who worked his or her tail off all their life for the benefits that they fully expected from their government. And at 65 years old, they were given the middle finger and told to buzz off because we ain't got the money. And I fear that eventually we won't do a damn thing until we get to that type of a crisis situation. You know, we're Americans. I think, unfortunately, we really don't do things until it kind of blows up.
Yeah. So talk about the, you know, do you follow politics now on a regular basis? And what's your read of, you know, it seems as if there are kind of three power blocks now, which is kind of interesting, because there's Trump and the Trump White House, there's the Republican Party, and there's the Democratic Party. And they don't all line up exactly right, whatnot. I mean, but do you have hope for the next 4 years, or are you kind of waiting for 2020 and, you know, and the 21st century to begin, and, you know, with a fresh piece of paper?
I think I heard in one of your podcasts that Justin Amash is considering a run in 2020 for president. I grew up in the funeral industry. Okay. Like, I grew up seeing death from a very young age. And I believe that either consciously or subconsciously that impressed upon me optimism, undying optimism. And I see that because, you know, in growing up, and as dark as it sounds, seeing dead bodies at a young age, it wasn't freaky or anything for me. It was something that I think I grew up with, knowing that, you know, you can either be a miserable POS and walk around mad and angry all the time, or you can live and attempt to be happy. And I try for the latter.
So that means you're not following politics.
I'm optimistic.
Anyway. Yeah. No. So yeah. what are you optimistic about? What are the points of optimism?
Netflix and chill.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to be an optimist these days, I'll tell you that. But I think a few things that you need to recognize, which are that really we as a society, I don't care if you're affiliated with a party or not, but realize that Donald Trump is not really a Republican in any sense of the traditional word, that he is this sort of autonomous thing. And I'll tell you what, a lot of the hardcore Trump supporters that I've talked with, they don't even they're either not registered Republican or maybe Republican, but could give a damn about any Republican other than Donald Trump. And so when we look at these issues, let me go back to my thing, if you will. You know, I think there are different people, whether it's people like us here being into punditry or grassroots or actual politicians, you sometimes have your thing, right? My things tend to be very libertarian issues, civil liberties, war on drugs, mass incarceration, and my major thing that I'm addressing now is spending. Donald Trump, to go back to what we were just talked about, said he's not even going to touch Medicare, Medicaid, or Social Security. He's not doing a thing.
Right.
That's part of the problem. You know, it's so insane to me how Paul Ryan was the darling of the conservative movement, so much so that Democrats were making videos of him murdering his own grandma. And now, yeah, and they loved him because of his take on spending and reining in our debt. And now Paul Ryan is a terrible man, part of the institution, and a squishy liberal. Well, that's crazy for me when that comes from Trump supporters, because Donald Trump isn't addressing these issues either. So what will get done here? I think not a whole lot is going to get done in terms of spending. I fear that Donald Trump is going to slip into George W. Bush era policy that led itself to be making Republicans disaffected, which was this: let's lower taxes, increase spending, and pray to God the economy booms.
Right.
And I'm afraid that's just not going to happen.
So what do you do you still consider yourself a Republican, and do you have faith that the GOP might turn more libertarian? There are people like, you mentioned Justin Amash, there's Thomas Massie from Kentucky, there's obviously Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky. Are they the future of the Republican Party, or is the Republican Party kind of in a slow, kind of self-asphyxiation of vague ideology into nothingness?
I believe with both parties, there has always been some vague ideology, but also the ideology flows in the context of its time, if that makes any sense, that it can shift, and it shifts depending on really the times that we're in, whether it's let me go back though to your question, because I do believe that if the Republican Party wants to continue to win general elections, especially even when we're looking at the White House or various Senate races across the country, I think that the future of the party is a more libertarian leaning party. And let me get even more specific about what upsets me, though, or what I'd like to see more out of a Rand Paul, a Justin Amash, or Tom Massie, which they've done some of, but I think they could do better, which is this. As myself, as a, whatever label we want to use, a libertarian, libertarian-leaning conservative, whatever it is, I think that the areas that Democrats and Republicans can agree on are essentially libertarian issues. And let's just take a look at the war on drugs. And the way that I look at this, I really, when I phrase it or talk about it, or even the way that I wrote in the book, I do it in a way because I think it's conservatives that need to be talked to. So let's take a, when we look at the war on drugs, I would use very Republican terminology and address, number one, social conservatives. Social conservatives, if you think that the war on drugs is a success, you know, what you're effectively doing are destroying families. You are tearing them apart, and you're taking a person, a nonviolent offender, who's done something which more than not has done something which would only affect him or herself. You've given them, they will lose any hope of finding a job when they get out of prison. And by the way, they've already spent however many years in prison, torn away from their families. If you are a social conservative and you believe in the religious ideology or the teachings of, for example, Jesus Christ, then damn it, execute it in your own life and realize that the war on drugs has failed. The second part to that is the fiscal conservatives. $80 billion a year we spend on locking up again an enormous amount of nonviolent offenders. And what do we do? Let's take a look at the fiscal ramifications there. Not only are we spending the $80 billion a year, but let's take a look at the individual. They get locked up. They get put on their record. They're never going to get hired again coming out of prison. You've put them in prison for life because they're either going to come out as an unproductive citizen or, worse, a hardened criminal. So I really think that Republicans like a Rand Paul, like a Justin Amash, we need to convince the Republican Party, and then it's an easy segue to sell on Democrats. And to finally button all of this up, why I believe that that's the future is these libertarian beliefs of civil liberties, war on drugs, mass incarceration, and foreign policy, which is a huge thing for me. I believe these are ways that we can go over to Democrats, that we can reach across the aisle, use that stupid cliche, and begin to find common ground to work on. And those are all based in libertarian belief.
All right. Well, Ed, we're going to leave it there. We have been talking with Trey Radel. He is a former congressman and the author of the fantastic new book, Demo Crazy, A True Story of Weird Politics, Money, Madness, and Finger Food. Trey, we didn't really talk about finger food, but there's some fairly disturbing descriptions of the amount of awful kind of chicken on a stick that you, I can see why you would have been, you know, coked out of your mind, to be quite honest, due to that. But
I
want
like that bad.
But the book is Demo Crazy. The author is Trey Radel. And what is the best way for people to check in on what you're up to?
Sure. Just usually Twitter is the easiest. And from Twitter, you can go to my Facebook, Instagram, all of that. And everything's all just Trey, T-R-E-Y, Radel, R-A-D-E-A-L. And Demo Crazy's on sale anywhere. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, all of them. And I really appreciate this, Nick.
Thank you. This has been The Reason Podcast, and I'm Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us.